Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we have a really great conversation planned with Susanna Cahalan, author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Brain on Fire, and her new book, The Great Pretender. It's such an exciting opportunity to talk with an accomplished author who, based on her own experience, her own inquisitive mind, really comes up at this interface between what's happening medically, what's happening psychologically, unknown diseases, whose research, I think, impacts so many of us and so many of our families. So I'm really looking forward to that conversation. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters that also, I think, impacts lots of people and lots of families. And this very first one came out and presented recently at the American Heart Association annual conference, and it has to do with people getting heart procedures, those metal stents that are placed in to help unclog arteries, and then also coronary artery bypass surgery, kind of the old gold standard when you had multiple arteries that were potentially going to occlude or be occluded. And, you know, nowadays, I think almost everyone would know someone who has had a stent placed. And this really looked at, were these stents and the bypass surgery recommended for people who perhaps have lots of coronary artery disease, but they're not having a heart attack, but yet they may be worried or on the verge of something like that, are those sorts of interventions actually better than medications? And a lot of people who are perhaps cardiologists would have said, yes, they're better. And a matter of fact, previous research that suggests there was no difference between the two wasn't done well enough. So this was actually a research study designed to actually look at that, because a decade ago, when they found out that these stents may not be better than medicines for preventing heart attacks and deaths in heart patients who weren't emergent, like if you weren't having a heart attack at the moment, that doesn't apply. A lot of doctors didn't believe these results. So this was a $100 million new study that spanned 37 countries and included people with pretty severe disease. Those who, if the stents and the bypass were really showing major impacts, they're most likely to have that impact. And over 5,000 participants all had stress tests, and they all showed that there was some sort of blockage. And all were given, you know, kind of lifestyle advice, you know, exercise, don't smoke, get your blood pressure under control, get your diabetes under control, and medicines that were to improve heart health. And half were also given CAT scans to make sure they didn't have a dangerous blockage. Then they were continued on medicines. They were then randomized, of course, to get this intervention, these stents or bypass, depending on what was deemed appropriate, or to just be managed with medication. And what they found over a long period of time is that after a year, 7% of those who had an adverse event if they were given a stent, but only 5% of those who were given on medication, an event being, you know, potentially a heart attack, cardiac arrest, hospitalization for chest pain, even death. After 4 years, 13% of those who had this invasive procedure had an adverse event, compared to 15% of those who were medicine. So over 4 years, actually, it turns out if you combine those two things, there was no difference between the two. And this is really pretty amazing. And I think one of the explanations given that makes the most sense to me is that, you know, when you're given a procedure, you're taking care of the artery you see. But there may be ones you don't see. There may be other impacts, versus you taking a medicine, you're actually taking care of all the blood vessels at one time. So it may well be that there are options for people that are safe and effective. Not everyone needs a stent or bypass. Some people might benefit from those. Really detecting who would benefit, who may not, well, that's the next stage, is to find out, really, you know, understand that better. But I think this tells me that for those who want to be managed with medicines alone, That's a reasonable request, but it's aggressive management, lowering the lipids as much as you can, getting the diabetes under good control, no smoking, getting the blood pressure down, taking an aspirin. These are the things that can be done. Really great research. Our next research that matters is something that I think on the other edge in the age spectrum, which is about young children. And this was studied in the Journal of American Medical Association subspecialty journal, Pediatrics. And it was really looking at brain scans that were being done on children, MRIs, on children age 3 to 5, looking at a section of the brain that's in development. And then it was looking at screen time. You really want at this age a score of 0, meaning that there is no screen in the child's bedroom. The child didn't start watching TV or using apps till they were over 18 months. There was no exposure to violent content. The total screen time for a preschool was an hour a day of high-quality program, watching with the parents, those types of things. That's a score of 0. A score of 26 meant total non-adherence. You started watching under a year, your screen's in the bedroom, you watch violent content, much more total screen time, not co-viewing. Well, what they found is that 41% of children had a screen in the bedroom, 60% had their own portable devices, and the average median screen time was 1.5 hours, but the range was 0 to 12 hours. Those things might be striking enough, but after looking at their analyses, those with higher screen scores, meaning they're exposed to a lot more screen time, their brain development actually was lower, lower measures of these nerve cells developing with language and literacy in particular. So a development of language skills, the development of reading skills, the things that most parents say, God, I'd love my child to be speaking and talking and reading. So this is really powerful. I think it does suggest that children need experiential. They need to be with them when they're doing these sorts of things, and that this has direct impact. That doesn't mean it can't catch up. It doesn't mean it won't happen, but it suggests there's some worrisome, I think, side effects. Our last research that matters is a global climate emergency, a report by almost 12,000 scientists in 153 countries looking at things that must be done to protect our planet. It's in the journal Bioscience, and it's really reducing greenhouse gases. We do understand that, but it's much more than that. They're really talking about other things that people may not think about, that we need drastic changes in economic growth and population policies. So it might include things for strengthening human rights, especially for women and girls, making family planning services more broadly available, energy efficiency, conservation to cut fossil fuels and renewable sources of energy. We need to cut soot and methane use, which short-term increase global warming. We need to move more towards plant-based diets rather than animal-based diets for sustainability. We need to be planting more trees. We need to reduce inequality across the planet. We need to really cut down on biodiversity loss, destruction of forests. It's a global crisis. We need global solutions, but these are doable things. I think it's a responsibility to our children, whether they're young children or most of us as adults, older children. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Susanna Cahalan, author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Brain on Fire, about her new book, The Great Pretender. You're listening to Your Health, and I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Susanna Cahalan, author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Brain on Fire, about her new book, The Great Pretender. Welcome, Susanna, to Your Health.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it is really great to have you. There's so many things I'm excited to talk about. So we're going to jump in, but I must say, you know, I think most of our listeners and certainly my wife, and it seems like her entire book club says, oh my gosh, you're going to be talking with Susanna Cahalan. Oh, you know, they know about Brain on Fire and like, they're all like, they all want to get this book. I'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you get interested in being a writer and a journalist? Tell us a little bit about you and your journey.
Oh, gosh. Well, I would have to say that I kind of always wanted to write. I wrote my first book when I was, I started it when I was probably 8 years old. And at the time, I had a babysitter who watched a lot of soap operas. So my little book that I was working on was filled with a lot of drama and intrigue. So that was kind of my first taste. And then I started becoming interested in journalism. And I started interning at the New York Post, which is a famous New York City tabloid. And I started working there when I was 17 and kind of quickly developed a love for the news cycle and investigative reporting. And, you know, and when you come from a tabloid, people don't necessarily want to open up at first. So it really tests your, just the kind of your skills. And so I cut my teeth there. And that's kind of how my story within writing and researching began.
So you have this lifelong love, really, of writing. You bring on kind of investigative journalism and really critically acclaimed book you come out with, Brain on Fire. Tell us how, because we're going to talk about The Great Pretender most of today's time, but I think we have to revisit that and understand how that health scare actually changed your life.
Oh, absolutely. I think you can't really understand my position within The Great Pretender without understanding like where it was born, and it came from Brain on Fire directly. So, you know, in 2009, I had my own health scare and my own experience with misdiagnosis when I started to really kind of feel very off, and that offness developed into full-blown hallucinations and psychosis, which was, you know, as you can imagine, very scary for my family and very scary for the physicians who were taking care of me. And at various points, I received, you know, various misdiagnoses. One of them was alcohol withdrawal. Another one was bipolar disorder. And yet another one was schizoaffective disorder. And I was in the hospital for a month until I was properly diagnosed with a very newly discovered form of autoimmune disease of the brain called autoimmune encephalitis. And from there, was exceedingly lucky on so many levels and was able to be, you know, essentially cured with a pretty basic treatment of steroids, IVIG treatment, and plasma exchange. And I emerged out of that. And, you know, initially, I didn't really want anyone to know what had happened to me because I didn't understand what had happened to me. All I knew was that I was psychotic, I was hallucinating, and these were scary things and they were shameful things that I didn't want anyone to know about. And so I kind of, you know, hid them for a while. And then as I emerged and recovered, which took a long time with, you know, anything that affects the brain, I started to realize that maybe I did want people to know about this. And as I started to learn about the illness, and it was fascinating, I started to have the kind of opposite reaction. I thought, I want everyone to know what I had in a way to kind of tell them what I didn't have. You know, I didn't have a psychiatric condition. That kind of became the narrative. You know, this was a neurological condition. It wasn't a psychiatric condition. And so that desire led to writing the book Brain on Fire, which kind of took on a life of its own that I could never have seen coming. And after that book was published, I was really surprised by the influx of people who, you know, either thought they had what I had, were searching for answers that were like mine, or were in the mental health community and weren't being seen. And that led me to start questioning some of the conclusions and some of the distance that I had developed between this idea of psychological or psychiatric and neurological. And that led me very much to The Great Pretender.
You know, it's so interesting how personal experience influences the narrative. And I'm thinking specifically about a couple of patients over 20 years that I've had, one of whom, you know, became psychotic and was found outside naked, you know, and when you're esteemed job in a very high functioning profession, that seems unusual. And it was so easy to think, oh, this person had a psychotic break, but to try to figure out what was going on was really different. And over time, we realized that this patient was on a medication and the medication could stay in your system for up to a week. And the medication, if you went and looked, talked about, you know, psychotic-like symptoms. And okay, now we knew what the cause was. And so when you know what a cause, you have something to do. But if you don't know the cause, and another patient for whom, you know, got sent to hospice because they thought he had some massive stroke and other things, and it turned out the patient at hospice got better, but almost died because everyone thought they were going to die. And so I wonder this experience of this interplay between the unknown and the known. Now here it's mental health and psychiatric and neurologic, But the known and the unknown, is that what intrigues? And this is your journalistic intrigue, is to really, let's delve into the unknown?
Absolutely. I think that's so beautifully put. You know, it is this kind of, you know, with my illness, we have a known, right? We can kind of pinpoint the cause and it feels very solid. But with a lot of psychiatric conditions, we don't have a similar approach and we don't know what causes. And I think that contributes to a lot of the stigma and a lot of the fear about it. I think the idea of the unknown is very unsettling, not only for the lay public, but for the profession too. We like to be on solid ground. And so this idea of, you know, what do we do in the face of the unknown in medicine? Because so much of medicine has an unknown. You know, what was shocking to me is I didn't know that we don't really understand how Tylenol works, or we don't really understand how anesthesia works. So these things that kind of the building blocks of our medical establishment, like we still don't know. So that was very eye-opening for me. But it's more heightened with psychiatry because we're dealing with the brain. And the brain is the great mystery. It's deep space, essentially. And I think what was shocking to me was not just how much we don't know, but how in our quest to solidify things and to feel safe on solid ground, we've filled in some of the unknowns with some certainty that doesn't exist. That was a kind of eye-opening, fascinating part of this journey to kind of uncover what medicine doesn't know, essentially.
How did you go from this personal, intense experience to an interest in a famous Stanford psychologist, David Rosenham, known for his work on in psychology and psychiatric diagnoses? How did you go from one to the other? What are the connecting the dots?
Well, it actually, again, came from a very personal place. After Brain on Fire was published, I would talk to anyone who would listen to me. And I ended up in a psychiatric hospital speaking about my condition. And after I talked, a doctor came up to me and said, "We think we have someone here who has what you have." And I found out 2 weeks later that they tested a young woman who had been in the hospital over the course of 2 years in and out for autoimmune encephalitis, and she tested positive. And the major difference between us was that I was misdiagnosed for 1 month and I would recover, and I recovered. And this woman, because of the length of time she was misdiagnosed, would never recover, in the doctor's words, and would operate as a quote-unquote permanent child. So this question of what is mental illness and what happens when you're diagnosed, does it close a door, open a door, really kind of galvanized me. And I told two neuroscientists about my experience. And one of them said to me, "You're a modern day pseudo patient," which I didn't know what that meant at the time.
It doesn't sound very good, by the way.
I don't know what that meant, right? So I said, "Well, you know, what do you mean by that?" And she kind of started talking about this study that was published in 1973 in Science Journal called On Being Sane in Insane Places. And in this study, 8 volunteers who were called pseudo patients went undercover in psychiatric hospitals around the country. And all they did was they presented with one symptom. They said, "I hear a voice that says thud," or "I hear a voice that says empty." And based on just that one symptom alone, all of them were diagnosed with serious mental illness. In all cases but one, they were all diagnosed with schizophrenia. That one case was manic depression. So it became, you know, once you've been labeled with, you know, a serious mental illness, how do you get well? How do you get perceived as well? And the fact was they didn't. You know, the average stay was 19 days. One person stayed for 52 days. It became everything they did within the context of a psychiatric hospital became further proof of their diagnosis. So when I read this study after this neuroscientist brought it up, I recognized so much of my own interests and experience within it. I mean, not just the misdiagnosis, which was obviously what she was referring to when she called me a pseudo patient, but I also saw the kind of depersonalization and the way that we see the world by what we are primed to see and how that affects the clinical gaze. So that was really, really interesting to me to read it in that beautifully written piece. For example, David Rosenham, the author of the study, writes about how when pseudo patients were hospitalized, they would write about their hospital stay. And this writing actually showed up in their medical records as evidence of writing behavior, which was proof or, you know, further fodder to kind of support their, you know, schizophrenia diagnosis. And I, too, had experienced that priming when I was initially misdiagnosed with bipolar disorder, and I wore a white T-shirt and black leggings, and that showed up in my medical record as revealing which supported my psychiatrist's bipolar diagnosis because she basically indicated some hypersexuality. So I really recognized so much of myself in that. And so I became very much obsessed with the study from that moment on.
All I'm going to say before the break is OMG. I mean, you know, how many patients would we have missed over decades if we didn't check depression and weird psychotic symptoms for our thyroid and uncover thyroid disease? I mean, you know, talk at the basic stuff. But we're going to take a short break. And then we come back. We're going to hear about David Rosenham and his experiment and how this affected the field of psychiatry and how you started to dig deeper in your new book, The Great Pretender. We'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with Susanna Cahalan, author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Brain on Fire, and her new book, The Great Pretender. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Susanna Cahalan, author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Brain on Fire, about her new book, The Great Pretender. And right before the break, Susanna, you were really beginning to tell us about David Rosenham and this work in the 1970s to explore mental illness. And tell us the experiment he did and the impact it had on psychiatry for decades.
Yeah. I don't think you can underestimate the effect this little study and essentially kind of like a stunt had on the field and on the lay public's view of psychiatry. This was published in 1973. You have to remember what the context was at the time. This was the time of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. This was the time of Snake Pit. This was the time of journalistic exposés, you know, every other week kind of showing how terrible it was in many of these institutions. It was also a time when psychiatry was a little bit lost. It was moving away from Freud. It was going into the great unknown. It didn't know where its place was in medicine. There were kind of a series of academic studies that were very embarrassing. There was one in particular called the US-UK study, which compared diagnoses here and across the pond and showed that here we were diagnosing the same patient population with schizophrenia, while overseas in the UK, they were diagnosing the same people with bipolar disorder. There was not uniformity. If you gave a psychiatrist a random patient, they would agree with another psychiatrist less than half the time on their diagnosis. Our diagnostic system was flawed at the very best, and the lay public didn't have a lot of faith in psychiatry. And so here comes this study that concludes, we cannot tell the difference, these are his words, between sanity and insanity. And it was, as one psychiatrist described it, a sword plunged into the heart of psychiatry. Extremely embarrassing, extremely transformative, and led to a kind of various movements that on the surface you would never connect. For example, patient rights movement, the biological kind of approach to psychiatry, to deinstitutionalization. I mean, all these different areas were affected by this study.
That all sounds great. You know, frankly, I mean, taking science and uncovering the truth, but something really begins to pique your interest that it's not just kind of getting in and unraveling. You're unraveling something that's really quite different than anyone's ever unraveled. What was the first clue that there was something else going on here? Because if it was just you writing a book about his experiment, I don't think we'd be talking today.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because the minute I read that study, I fell in love with it. So I started to think, I want to know more about these, not only the writer of the study, David Rosenham, but the seven other participants who, you know, kind of put their lives in jeopardy to do this. Who are these people? Why did they decide to do that? That led me to, unfortunately, David Rosenham had passed away a year before I started this book, but he left behind an unpublished book. And he left behind diary entries and, you know, a lifetime of correspondences and letters. So I started digging through that and found amazing things about David Rosenham's own hospitalization. He was one of the pseudo patients. And at first, everything kind of squared away and checked off, and I felt really excited about what I was finding. But bit by bit, some questions started to emerge. One of them was he had obscured the names of all the pseudo patients, the other people involved in the study, to such a great degree, not only in his public notes, but in his private notes, there was a huge level of secrecy involved. And I didn't really quite understand why. And there was another question. He had written this book. It was almost done. And he had gotten a contract with a major publisher who were very excited about the book. And he never produced the book and was actually sued because he never delivered it. And I thought, why didn't he do it? He had the book ready. Why didn't he release this? And there was also the question of why, after this study was published, which made him a huge academic celebrity, he never published on this topic again, on the topic of serious mental illness and hospitalization. This made his career, yet he totally dropped it as a subject after he did this study.
He was a serious academic, right? I mean, he had academic credentials that bought him entry into universities combined with the study anywhere in the world.
Absolutely, especially after the study was published, for sure, definitely.
So you had all these really unanswered questions, and that pushed you to question the essence of his research.
Well, yes. I mean, that led me to dig deeper. And at that point, I started to find some inconsistencies with numbers and with the data, because some of the strengths of the piece is that there are some hard data in this softer science piece. You know, there's the total number of pills dispensed, serious psychopharmaceuticals, which were 2,100 pills. You know, there's the amount of time psychiatrists spent on the floor in kind of, you know, 26.7 minutes, very specific numbers. And I was not finding a lot of evidence, you know, what were her, how did he gather this data? Why were there discrepancies with the numbers? So that was another indication that something was awry. And then kind of the big reveal for me was when I found his medical records.
And what was the big reveal?
So the big part of the study is that the patients themselves, the pseudo patients, would only exhibit one symptom, right? They would say, I hear a voice that says thud, empty, hoplo. And everything else had to be consistent across the 8 pseudo patients so that there was some kind of standardized structure in terms of how they were conducting this experiment. When I got access to his medical records, I found that the story was far more complicated. David Rosenhan didn't just say, I hear a voice that says thud, empty, hollow. He said, I hear a voice that says thud, empty, hollow, and I put copper pots over my ears to drown out the noises. Also, radio signals are talking to me. I can hear what people are thinking, and I am suicidal. So I'm sure, you know, you have encountered people who are struggling with mental illness. I mean, if someone says to you, I am suicidal, I'm sure that's cause for concern, deep concern from you.
Absolutely.
So to me, that really indicated, okay, well, what else about this story isn't as it appeared? And so that sent me down another kind of rabbit hole of research.
So help us understand what you're hoping for those that look at this book to get out of it. What journey would you like them to explore?
You know, I think there's a few, but I think one of the most important ones is that, you know, the history of psychiatry and medicine is our shared history. Whether or not we are directly affected by serious mental illness, which many of us are, or even by through our loved ones, this is a shared history. And so by looking back to this foundational study that had such a huge effect on where we are now, I mean, it had an effect on deinstitutionalization and the closing of institutions. It had an effect on the creation of the DSM, which is the Bible of psychiatry, and, you know, kind of where we get our diagnostic system today. So this allows us to kind of go backwards and see, how have we progressed? How have we not? In fact, my favorite doctor, the man who saved my life, a man named Dr. Sual Najjar, tells his residents when he's teaching them about how to take a patient history, that he always says, you have to look backwards to see the future. And I'm hoping that this book contributes to a look backwards to allow us to assess where we are today and hopefully move towards a better path in the future.
And do you expect there to be a reexamination of this work? Would there be ever a space and place for science to recant or to relook? Is that part of what needs to occur in terms of kind of historical record?
I don't think so. I think because it's too late for that now. I mean, it had the effect that it had. It's not going to change anything. Science actually did review my book in a very nice way, but they didn't actually acknowledge that they were the ones who published the study, which is funny. But what I hope happens is it's a teachable moment. I hope we don't discard this study and just forget that it happened. I hope that we now reframe it and still teach it, but allow for some skepticism, some interrogation, some kind of questioning of the status quo that this study raises. And I hope that some of the conclusions that are very valid, you know, the parts about being seen through the prism of your mental illness, the idea of labeling and the role of context in diagnosis, these are all real things that I hope are not forgotten as I've raised some questions about some of the validity of the findings. There's still a lot of truth there. So I hope that both things can happen at the same time.
Well, I oftentimes tell my patients and my colleagues, the difference between my patients and myself is very little. And I think that's probably the truth sometimes between what we think is sane and insane. It's very little. And that should be humbling for all of us. Well, really, really appreciate you, Susanna Cahalan, for writing a book that makes us think, but also it's a thrilling journey to go on. It's so much fun to go with you on journeys. Let us know where you're going to go next. We're going to put this link to this. I'm going to encourage our listeners to get it, explore it, put it in your book clubs is what I'm going to say, because there's way too much here to not talk about with others.
Oh, thank you so much. What a pleasure. And thanks for having me on. This is wonderful.
We've been talking with Susanna Cahalan, author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Brain on Fire, about her new book, The Great Pretender. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Laura, if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send the comments directly to yourhealth@unc.edu. What do we have today? I'm sure that there's always something interesting.
Always something interesting. Our listeners have very interesting questions. And the first one is, I've had COPD for 10 plus years, and it always seems like a mystery to me why I get flare-ups and which flares need treatment. I'm sure this is probably a common problem for people out there like me, and there must be a science behind the situation. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is one of the most common, if not the most common, pulmonary respiratory lung disease there is. The great majority, but not all, is linked to smoking.
Right.
And even after you quit smoking, people can develop it because of the damage that's occurred. And of course, the single best thing they can do is to quit smoking if they haven't. That and oxygen really seem to have some effects. What is a flare of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease? What is a flare when you start coughing? You know, how do you know when your coughing needs antibiotics?
When it's persistent.
Persistent.
Yeah, it intensifies.
Getting worse. Yeah. Start getting a lot of green or yellow stuff. Start having maybe a fever. Start getting tired.
Sure.
So take all of that and take someone whose immune system and their lungs are not very good, and they can't afford to actually get that infection because their lungs have less reserve.
Okay.
And you just say they may need treatment earlier,
right?
And the science is, if you're a doctor that's seen someone with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and you've seen hundreds of cases, you know that if you treat them a little bit earlier, because you're listening to their phlegm has changed, maybe it hadn't turned green or yellow, but their phlegm has changed, they don't feel so good, they're coughing a little bit more, let me get on top of this. Now, it could just be that they need an anti-inflammatory like prednisone, but that's maybe if they're wheezing. But if they're really coughing and phlegm is increasing, they may need some antibiotics, which is frequently what you need to make the decision tree. Is there a science? Yes. Is there also an art? Yes. What's our very next house call?
I'm 40 years old and have a really strong family history of heart attacks to men in my family who are around the age of 50. It seems like they all had really elevated cholesterol levels, and while mine is not too high, it does seem like I should probably start doing something beyond just taking blood pressure meds and exercising. Is there any data I should be aware of about this?
Well, there is data here, and I think that this is really important because what you're really saying is, do you have really genetic tendencies to this high cholesterol we call familial hypercholesterolemia. That's a mouthful, FH.
Yeah.
Family history of
that
high cholesterol.
That certainly shortens it a lot.
Shortens a lot. And there are different genetic mutations that are responsible for this. And you can base it somewhat on clinical criteria, but nowadays there are genetic testing increasingly that people have, and it tends to run in families. So if, you know, all people in your family, and I don't think it would just be males, then it suggests that, you know, really high cholesterol, like an LDL cholesterol, which normally should be less than 120, if you're in your family it's 220, that suggests, you know, there's really a problem there. And I think regardless, aggressive lowering of the lipids is highly indicated because lifespan is significantly shortened in the absence of that. And for every level of that LDL, the bad cholesterol, it's a worse prognosis if you have this familial gene than if you don't have it. So if you are worried that you have it or your doctor's worried, they should probably see a lipid specialist.
Okay.
You would certainly be on a statin, but you might be on two or three other drugs. You might be on fish oil. You might be on niacin. There are other drugs that you may do to try to really lower that high-dose statin. These are complicated things. Seeing someone who really specializes in this would be useful.
But bravo for thinking ahead like that and starting to consider it.
Age 40, get this treated.
Yeah.
Great idea.
Yeah.
What's our very last house call?
This might seem like a silly question, but I am 90 years old now, and I'm in really good health. What things can I do to make sure that I make it to 100?
I love that question.
I know. I like this person.
Yeah.
It's a great question.
And as I get closer to that age than I do to, let's say, a child's age, I get more excited about that question.
Right?
Right. And, you know, what's interesting is if you made it to 90, you already suggest that you're doing many things right.
Yeah, no kidding.
You're already, 10 years over the average for, let's say, a man. And it suggests to me that, you know, what are you doing that's working well? You may not be on very many medicines. You may be exercising more regularly. You may be really trying to take care of yourself in terms of whatever, if you have some medical conditions, that they may be more controlled. So first off, keep doing what you're doing.
Right.
Right? Don't back off. I think Mr. Rogers swam every day of his life when he got up. That's what I heard.
Oh, Mr. Rogers.
You know?
So good.
So good. And the other thing is, think about what's likely to change. So falls become a really big issue. So people, when they're exercising, they need to not only do the aerobic, get the heart rate up, they need to do flexibility, they need to do balance.
Right.
They need to do kind of mobility and stretching. Those are things that we don't think about as much. Think about, even common medicines can have side effects. So, you know, could you take Tylenol if you needed something for pain rather than aspirin or things? Because aspirin could be really dangerous for someone who's older, or ibuprofen could be dangerous. We don't know. No medicine would be better than these medicines even. So immunizations, are there shots? Getting your flu shot clearly. If you've not had your pneumonia shot clearly. These are things that are kind of no-nonsense good things.
Yeah, just almost prevention in some ways, in a lot of ways.
Right. You know what we say in medicine? The first rule you're taught as a budding doctor, it's got a Latin term for it, but I'd be making up the term right now because I don't remember. Nolle dolda. Do no harm.
Do no harm. There
you
go.
Do no harm. And that's sometimes, I think, what we do is like, you're doing really good. I just got to make sure I don't harm you.
Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Let's just not break it more or anything like that.
Yeah.
Great.
So, well, thank you for that question. I want to thank all of our listeners today for questions that we've addressed and issues that are concerns that are important to you. You can share anything with us by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter or Facebook. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Susanna Cahalan. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.